Okay, my name is Kathleen Holt. This is January 23rd, 2015, and it is about 10:30 in the morning. I am at the Topeka Public Library with Mr. Timken, and we're going to be talking today about his experience in the serving in the military in the Korean War. Mr. Timken, would you introduce yourself, please, and give us your birth date and the city in which you were born?
I'm Frank Darrell Timken. I was born July the 14th, 1930, in Dodge City, Kansas.
Okay. Mr. Timken, you served in which branch of the military?
The U.S. Army.
Okay. And what battalion, regiment, division, that kind of thing. Can you describe those units that you were in during your service?
Well, I went through basic at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas in the 542nd Field Artillery Battalion. That was 16 weeks of training there. And then I was sent to Korea, and there I was in Headquarters Battery of the 196th Field Artillery Battalion of 10th Corps Artillery. Later on, I was transferred to 10th Corps Artillery Headquarters, and then I was transferred to Headquarters Battery of the 49th Field Artillery Battalion of the 7th Infantry Division.
So 49th Field Artillery, I can't write that fast, artillery of the
7th Infantry Division.
7th Infantry Division. Was that common to be in that many, four different?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I was even in my final assignment was in headquarters and headquarters battery of the 7th Division Artillery Headquarters.
Wow. So I bet we're going to hear an interesting experience.
Well, travel experience, yeah.
Okay. Did you enlist in the service or were you drafted?
I was drafted.
Okay. And basically, what were your service dates?
Well, they were January the 6th, 1953, to October the 21st, 1954. And at that time, when I was separated, mm-hmm. they allowed me to spend required, I guess you could say, 6 years in inactive reserve in the Army.
Okay.
So I wasn't officially separated from the service until January of 1961.
Okay. All right. And we have a list of some of your medals and awards. Which we will include in this information, but is there anything specific you can tell us about any of those awards?
Well, one of the awards is the United States Korean Service Medal, and it's with one bronze service star. That bronze service star usually sometimes it's described as a battle star.
Okay.
And I think in Korea, during the Korean War, battle stars were given for a period of time, mostly. You might think of a battle like Gettysburg, but that one service battle star represents for me the summer campaign of 1953. Season.
Okay.
And I guess one of the other medals is the Republic of Korea Korean War Service Medal, which was given about 50 years after the war. I had to write to San Antonio, Texas, to receive it. But as I understand it, the government wouldn't accept that medal for servicemen to wear back in 1953. And then they later on awarded Vietnam medals to their veterans, and so they backtracked and allowed the Korean government medal to be worn by the Korean veterans.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it is nice.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's kind of start our official part of the interview. I'm going to reintroduce myself, and then we'll get started on talking about your experience in the interview. I'm Kathleen Holt. This is January 23rd, 2015. We are at the Topeka Public Library, and I am with Mr. Timken, who will introduce himself and tell us where you were born, what date, and then we'll be ready to go. Your name?
I am Frank Darrell Timken. I was born July the 14th, 1930, at Trinity Hospital in Dodge City, Kansas. I grew up on a farm about 3 miles north of Cimarron on Highway 23, and graduated from Cimarron High School in 1948, and enrolled at Kansas University in the fall of 1948. I completed my college in July of 1953. Of course, the Korean War started in 1950, and I received a college deferment. During my college years, they had rules and regulations, like you had to have a certain grade average and you had to be working toward an end. And but I was able to finish my college work through that deferment. 52.
Oh, okay.
August of 1952, yes. And at that time, when I notified the draft board, I had decided that I had completed, why that made me eligible for the draft, and I decided to go ahead and be drafted rather than enlist. I had a good friend, John Pixley, who went the other route. He had finished his college in the summer of 1952 from Kansas State, and he was going to enlist in the Air Force, which he did, and in the fall of 1952, and he ended up staying over 20 years in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. I think retired as a lieutenant colonel. But I decided on the draft. He said, "Well, you're going to Korea," and that's true. That's where I ended up. But after my military service, I came back and taught school. I had a degree in secondary education, and I taught at Lansing, Kansas, Augusta, Kansas, and in Topeka for a total of altogether 34 years, 35 years. Yeah. And I'm retired. At this time, I'm 84 years old, and so that's about it insofar as the background.
And tell me, I also want to introduce someone else that's here with us, or have you introduce your wife, your lovely wife, and tell us when you were married. And
okay. Yes, my wife figures in pretty much in my military service and decision for the draft and 2 years of service, in that my wife was Clarice Buttrin, and she taught music at Cimarron Public Schools from 1951 to 53. I met her the summer of 50, or in fall of 52, and I was helping my father and brother farm and plant the fall wheat crop and so forth, waiting on the draft. And we got engaged before I enlisted before I entered the service. And we got married then. I had a 10-day delay en route, a leave, from the time I left Camp Chappie until I had to report to board a troop train. And at that time, we got married. That was May the 12th, 1953. So that was part of the decision for the two-year thing.
And she's here today to keep you straight on
those
dates, too.
That's right. She's keeping track of things.
Family archivist there. Well, that's good. Okay. And is it Clarice?
Well, I pronounce it Clarice.
Clarice, okay.
That was the way my father knew someone that was Clarice.
Oh, okay. That's beautiful.
Alice and Janice.
Okay. Uh-huh.
If you're over a certain age, it's probably Clarice. And if you're younger, it's probably Clarice.
Oh, I see. And spelled I-C or I-S? Okay, I-C-E. And how did you spell your last name? Your maiden name?
Buttron.
I got that as incorrect as I possibly could. Okay, good, great. We're glad you're here. One question I forgot to ask from our form. What was the highest rank you achieved in service?
It was an E5, okay. A sergeant.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to put the paperwork aside, and what I would like for you to do is start out telling me, you've told us a little bit here about your decision to, you made it through college, and then you were drafted, and it sounds like you did a lot between the time college and getting ready for that draft. You kind of knew it was coming, or how did you find out finally that you were drafted? Where were you and what were you doing then?
Well, like I said, we had to notify the draft board when we completed college. And I thought I would get more quicker information since I finished in July. I thought they would let me know what the situation was quicker, but it wasn't until October that I got a message from them to report for my physical. So I went to, caught the bus at Dodd City, and which picked up such persons, and had my physical, and then came home to wait for the draft. I think one of the problems, as I understood, with the draft board, their secretary had an operation, and everything came to a halt insofar as the draft board. It was a three-person draft board from Hodgman County, Ford County, and Gray County. And the Gray County representative was Wiley Parker, who was a farm neighbor of us. He lived a half mile south of our farm. Once I passed the physical and came home, well, then I waited again. But the day before Christmas, I got a card from the Selective Service, greetings. And it had something to the effect, something about from your neighbors, why mm-hmm. you were asked to report. And it was truly a neighbor. Wiley lived half a mile mm-hmm. down the road. And when I left Cimarron to report, I had come home on leave, and report to get to the troop train. Why Wiley was there on the street. My brother was taking me where I needed to go. Wiley came down and talked to me and visited with me on Main Street in Cimarron before I left. At that time, then I reported to Kansas City again and was sworn in there at the Center, Army Center, and went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, where I was processed further, got shots. And that was after January the 6th. And so I was just there a week or so or less. Then I was sent to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, where I took 8 weeks of basic training, and then I took 8 weeks of advanced training. And the military occupation specialty, the MOS that I received from my advanced training was fire direction control, in artillery. And I think there, well, Clarice came down. She brought my folks down one time there to visit me. And she had to, I wanted a weekend pass to get, have more freedom. And she had to go in and see the battery commander and be interviewed by the Army so I could get my pass. But I did get a pass.
Had to work for it.
But after that 16 weeks of training, I had the delay en route pass, and then I went to Fort, by troop train, to Fort Lewis, Washington, in the middle of, near the beginning of June, I guess. I know it was Queen Elizabeth was crowned or something.
Oh.
At that time on TV. I know we were in Seattle. Clarice came up there because I was up there a week or so. And you could watch it on Windows and TV, this business of her father had died and coronation. And the coronation of her. Mm-hmm. But we went by troop ship to Korea. We landed first at Sasebo, Japan, where we got off the troop ship, and we picked up any mail there that was waiting for us. We went to our barracks. I think they issued us a rifle the next morning, and we went out on the firing range and shot it. As I understand, in the early months of the Korean War, they sent troops to Korea with rifles that didn't function. So we had to actually fire our rifle, and then we boarded the same troop ship that day. We were in Sasebo, Japan, about one day, and we went around on the west side of Korea and debarked at, or landed at Incheon, Korea. From there, I went to by a night train, very slowly. I don't suppose it went more than 15 or 20 miles an hour. Very dark, shades pulled down, to Chuncheon, to Korea, to a replacement depot, and was assigned there to the headquarters battery of the 196th Field Artillery Battalion. And that battalion was located about on the eastern front. It was about 20 miles north of the 38th parallel, and it was on the line firing, and had been on the line for about over a year. And I was assigned there to the S2 section, which is the intelligence section of the 196th Field Artillery Battalion. It was a small section made up of about an officer and two enlisted men, and then we had the forward observation post on the front line, and there were two or three in each one of those. So it was a section of less than 10 people. My first assignment, even before I went to the S2 section one day, was to finish digging a sump hole for the mess sergeant.
That took a lot of intelligence.
Yeah. But that was where they threw the leftovers and threw dirt on top of it.
Oh.
A big hole, mm-hmm. and about as deep as I was tall. And when I was doing that, suddenly I looked up and there were two lieutenant colonels looking down on me. And I was, having gone through basic training, anything higher than a PFC was pretty big rank. And one of them was a battalion commander, and one of them was a chaplain who was assigned, or he stayed in our battalion. Of course, I didn't know what to do. I just kept digging. And they didn't say nothing. And I kept digging, and they walked away. So I think that was the official visit with my battalion commander. I didn't know what to do, you know, with a shovel in my hand, whether to salute or not. But my main function, well, I arrived in Korea in the middle of June of 53, and the war ceasefire came the last of July of 53. So I was there during the war, the last 6 weeks of the war. And during that time, I was mainly the Jeep driver for the intelligence officer. We were about 3 miles from the front, I estimate, and very rugged, mountainous country. And the roads were kind of like the road up from Florence, Colorado to Cripple Creek, Colorado, probably in 1911. It was very rough country. We were only about the artillery. The artillery that made up the 196th was 155 millimeter howitzers, and they could fire about 10 miles. And so we'd drive up to the front several times a week. The forward observers not only directed fire, but they also gathered intelligence information. They were our eyes, so to speak. And so to keep the morale up, the intelligence officer would often take them up a candy bar, take them up their mail, something like that. And it was on those trips while we had two observation posts. We would come under fire because they could observe us. We'd lower the windshield of our Jeep to reduce the reflections, but they could see us the enemy could see us. And sometimes we'd go around we'd be coming around a side of a mountain, and you'd come around here, and they'd, on one side they could see your dust or reflection. They'd try to estimate how fast you were going, and you'd come around on the other side, and you'd see these puffs of dirt coming down the road. It was mortar fire. Mm-hmm. And so you had to back up and get out of there. Sometimes there were Korean workers, work gangs, road gangs, and they'd be running toward you. That's the first thing you'd notice, mm-hmm. that something was going on. We were also about 20 miles from the Sea of Japan. We couldn't see the ocean. I drove the officer over to the ocean one time because we had naval officers assigned to our fire direction center. And so if our battalion came under enemy artillery fire, we'd call upon the naval gunnery officers would call upon fire from the cruisers or battleships not far from us, and they would open up. There was very little action at that time in the daytime in Korea. You have to keep remember that the last year and a half of the war, things were pretty stable or static. There'd be pushes occasionally, probes, fights, but they were involved in trying to reach a ceasefire, I guess. And maybe one unit, the U.S. or the Koreans, North Koreans and Chinese, would try to get the high point of ground. And I don't know, our unit in Korea, we had a little town, a little military town. I guess I use the word town because we had an aid station. We had a smoke pot unit, or I guess a chemical warfare unit, but what they did, they tended these fires in smoke in pots that would cover the road, so the road wasn't visible to the enemy, traffic on the road. And we had a searchlight unit under certain circumstances. It was, the clouds were low, they could move these searchlights up and shine them in the clouds and illuminate the front line, because activity was at night mainly. And so that meant the artillery was at night. They were firing all night long usually. If you had a letter from home or something like that, and you went back to your tent to read the letter, why, once those guns started firing, and we had a battery of long toms or 155 howitzers with a long barrel, which could fire 14 miles behind us, the air concussion when they went off, our illumination in the tent was candles. And so you just quit reading your letter. We did had we had flashlights issued to us, but you couldn't walk down to the dime store to get batteries. You had to go down to the supply sergeant to get batteries. And so if you use that flashlight for very much and went back and forth while they knew what you were doing. We usually used the flashlight when we had guard duty. And I might mention guard duty here. It seemed like I did a lot of guard duty. We had to supply our own security. And so I did a lot of private of the guard, corporal of the guard, sergeant of the guard, all that. And it was usually on 2 hours, like you did the 6 o'clock, 6 to 8, and then the 12 to 2 shift. Wow. And the nice thing about that Korea Guard duty, there was a nice thing, it wasn't very formal, like service in the United States, where inspections were pretty severe sometimes.
Tell me a little more about that. What did you have to walk a perimeter?
Well, we had stationary guard duties. In other words, we had 3 guard posts. We had one on a ridge where our communications tent was. I think we were still using World War II radio equipment and that sort of business. And then we had 2 guard posts, the artillery battery that was behind us was, they provided a guard post. And I think that was pretty much it insofar as guard duty. I did help out a little bit in the Fire Direction Center when I was there early, as well as my Jeep driving and guard duty. For instance, if they needed some help on the radio, I would serve as a radio. But I never did do the actual Fire Direction Center work for what I was trained, which I guess is normal for the Army. You end up not doing what you were trained to do. But so the ceasefire came, and I might say there are probably big things about my service in Korea. I was there during the ceasefire. Not everybody was. And for our artillery unit, that night, we were going to cease fire, I think, at 10 o'clock, or that would have been, what, 2,200 hours. Our fire mission, our last fire mission was at 9 o'clock that night. And when that was finished, our artillery unit didn't fire anymore. Insofar as any celebration or anything like that, I don't recall much going on. For one thing, we didn't know what really was going on, what would happen again, you know, would it start up again? Things like that. And the next day, we had, I guess the commanding officers had gotten down what would have to take place if it was signed and when it was signed, because we got our assignments for the 2.5 mile wide DMZ that had to be created. And so one of our duties was to one of our observation posts was in inside the DMZ would be, so we had to go up and get it out and move it back, and that everything had to be done, I think, in 30 days. So that took quite a bit of time. And I might mention here some people might be interested, well, just exactly where were you? One of our OPs was on the north rim of the Punch Bowl, and that's kind of a known battle field earlier in the war. The 1st Marine Division was there, 7th Infantry Division was there at that time. And places like, and in front of that OP was a rock structure known as Luke the Gook's Castle. And there were caves in there. And we could drive clear up to the front line in the daytime. That might sound kind of strange. You drive up to the back of the front line, and sometimes I'd get out of the Jeep and go up to watch what was happening. I know I saw planes drop napalm on Luke the Gook's castle. Tremendous flash of flame. I don't know how they survived. But the enemy here again, it was so rugged that the North Koreans couldn't pull up very large artillery pieces. By that I mean their size was like a 75 or 76 millimeter compared to our 155. They had to pull them up by hand, and they put them in caves. And then when they wanted to counterfire, well, they'd pull them out of the caves and fire. Two other places that were real close to the Punch Bowl was Heartbreak Ridge and I forget now what the other one was. I can't think of it now. The other kind of thing that kind of stands out is that after the ceasefire came, why, the front line got closer to our artillery unit. We didn't move back. In some places, the infantry had to move back. But the 196th Field Artillery Battalion was the northernmost American unit of battalion size in Korea after the war. And I don't know whether that was a good thing or not. Of course, that meant that in front of us then were South Korean infantry divisions. To our left side, why, it was the 45th Infantry Division, which was the Oklahoma National Guard Division, which was sent over there.
Wow.
Let's see. Oh, if we did, the artillery unit did get fired upon. I think it was my birthday, July 14th of 53. Maybe that's one reason I remember the time. But we had been told the day before by our first sergeant to dig deeper foxholes in the area that we were going to come under enemy fire. They didn't quite know when. But the weather was right, conditions were right, their artillery to reach us, and we had been fired on before when I wasn't there. Sure. And sure enough, we waited around on Saturday, and so the soil was rocky, hard to dig in, but we all of us dug our foxholes deeper, but I for some reason decided that maybe I should get the Jeep that I drove and take it down to the gas dump. There was a little fenced-in facility where they kept gasoline in barrels and motor oil and that sort of stuff. I'd look at the Jeep. The intelligence officer might want to go someplace and we might have to move. So I'd move the Jeep down 100 yards, I suppose, and was down there when the fire, enemy fire, came in. And it did. We, in the tent that we lived in, a number of us, why, a shell did go through and hit on the other side, and shrapnel just blew that tent all to smithereens. I had a little photograph of Clarus in a container like this, kind of propped up on, and it survived, but the tent didn't survive.
Wow.
And I had run to a gully and jumped down in it. It was deep, maybe 4 or 5 feet deep, and that's where I stayed while they fired. And sure enough, there was somebody there that was my first sergeant. He was already in the gully. So I was in good company. But we had the artillery unit back of us, four long toms. They went into action. The enemy artillery fire didn't reach them. And the naval guns started up. And so the enemy artillery fire kind of slowly came to a halt that afternoon. I suppose the closest time I ever came to getting shot, though, was one time I went up to the, drove up to the forward observation post and was sitting in the Jeep, and a sergeant came rushing through the brush and he grabbed my carbine and smelled it. And what the situation was, somebody along the front line had been firing down into the brush, just firing down there, you know. And some of our fellas. And meanwhile, his communication group was down there repairing telephone wires. Now, that sounds like the old days, all right, to have telephone wires. And you can imagine they always needed repaired, be repaired. Or I did hear one time the Koreans would go out and steal the wire, then cut it to use for rope or something, you know. But they were down there, and the fire came close to them. I'm sure that if he had smelled smoke in my carbine, why, he might have shot me. He was very mad. And insofar as weapons that I carried, I was issued in Japan a M1 rifle, and I carried it for a while. And then I was given a carbine, which was a shorter rifle. If you wanted to carry something, that was the neat one to carry. But it, if you were to fight somebody, you wanted the rifle. But it was kind of a status symbol. If you carried a rifle in the artillery, why, it meant you hadn't been there very long. And you got promoted up after a while. People went home, the carbine people, and so they issued you a carbine instead of a rifle. I did carry when I was driving, I did carry a grease gun, which was a 45 caliber submachine gun. And sometimes on guard duty, I'd carry a when I was a sergeant, I'd carry a 45. And I would tell you that I had never fired either one of those weapons in training. And so I don't know what would happen if I needed to, if it had jammed up.
Yeah, just for show, huh?
So, but that's, I guess that's how we operated. Now, the ceasefire came the last of July. And I might say the relationship of the headquarters battery to the firing batteries, we were just back of a hill from the firing batteries, Abel, Baker, and Charlie. And there were six howitzers in each battery, so there were 18 howitzers in front of us. And then we had the four long toms behind us. And then there was a service battery where it was supplies. For instance, if they were firing heavy at night, trucks were bringing ammunition up to the howitzers all night long. But they were stored down at the firing battery. They didn't keep down at the service battery. They didn't keep very many shells up by the guns any more than necessary. And I might say there we did have that one day that I talked about. We got shelled. We did have one gunnery sergeant get the Silver Star because he put out a fire that had started close to the ammunition pile in one of his howitzers. And we did have, while I was there, there were two that got killed by enemy fire. And I don't know how many got wounded. When the ceasefire came, it did roughly the same job, except they asked me if I wanted a change of jobs, and so I became in the intelligence section in headquarters battery. There was the officer, there was a non-commissioned officer, in that case it was a master sergeant, and there was me, three of us. And so they promoted me to corporal, well, PFC, and then to corporal. I suppose I really got promoted fast. I got two ranks in about a month. But I became the NCO in the intelligence section. And this was after the ceasefire. I obtained security, secret clearance. I guess they were around Lancaster, her hometown, asking questions about me. I don't know if they ever went around Cimarron. But I had security clearance of secret. And I would do things like decode of words for the passwords for a week came down from Corps Artillery Headquarters. And so I'd decode those. Every Sunday, I think they'd come by telephone in code. And then I'd get the password codes up to the medical unit and up to the searchlight unit and up to the smoke pot people and so forth.
Let me ask you, so it came, was it like a letter code or number codes, or you had a, okay.
Yeah.
That was pre-computer time, I would assume, so you just did it manually?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, very crude, so to speak. And, of course, I had no training. I was not trained in that. I do know fellows that were trained, really trained in code work. For instance, they knew when President-elect Eisenhower was coming, you know, that sort of business. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would receive other kinds of codes, and I would work on those. Of course, I had the intelligence officer as support and background and check. I knew the combination to the safe. We had a safe. And if we went out on, had some reason, for instance, we'd sometimes take two howitzers and go down to a place and practice firing. What do you do when you have a ceasefire? And one of the things you realize about Korea, you didn't come in as a unit and leave as a unit like they do now in Afghanistan. We rotated constantly, a change of people, which meant at one time I know I suddenly realized that there weren't very many fellows in the 196th that were there when combat was going on. But if we had to move out some and go down and practice, it'd mean that sometimes we would evacuate other units just for practice. And so we had to move that safe. And I was the babysitter for the safe. It was a safe about that size. And I was responsible for carrying a thermite grenade, which is a heat grenade that would melt through metal. And under the order, you know, the intelligence officer said, well, it needs to be destroyed. We're going to get captured. Then I would pull the pin or set it on the safe, and it would melt through and hopefully destroy what was inside. Sometimes I would, we'd get rid of classified material that was in the safe, and so I'd witness some of that stuff, the burning of it and so forth. One time we had to, the commanding officer wanted to send the second in command, the major, to Japan to a meeting, and he had to have top secret clearance. Well, he just had secret clearance, but the colonel wanted him to go. So we sat feverishly looking at army manuals, and the officer finally found some paragraph, you know, that temporarily he could issue top secret. Wow. I don't know if it was legal or not, but we had the warrant officer down in the headquarters write up a nice official letter, and off he went to Japan, and he made it to the meeting. So those were really invigorating things to do.
Yeah.
Later on, I was with the 196th about 9 months. I was over there 15 months, probably overseas 16 months if you include the time of the troop ship. The going and coming takes a few days. But I was in Korea about 15 months. And but in the spring of 1954, they asked me if I wanted to go down and work at Division 10th Corps Division Artillery headquarters. And I said, sure, I'd go down there. I figured the food would be better, and but the militariness of the situation would probably be higher, meaning there would be more spit and polish. But about 2 weeks after I got down to 10th Corps, artillery headquarters, they said it was moving. And I thought, my, what's going on? The rumor was out. And the rumor was they were going to Indochina. At that time, the French were losing a big battle at Dien Bien Phu, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And President Eisenhower, I guess, was under pressure. What kind of aid would he send? Well, he did send some kind of aid, I guess, evacuation planes and so forth. But he ended up not sending any military aid. So we didn't go there, and that wasn't it. 10th Corps units were starting to be transferred out of Korea, and 10th Corps headquarters, artillery headquarters, were coming back to the United States. And since I had time left, well, I stayed in Korea, but a small group and the colors and everything came back, and lo and behold, they came back to Fort Riley. So I wished I would have come back to with the headquarters, but that was one reason for a move. Then they sent me to the 49th Field Artillery Battalion headquarters, and I was put in the... I was a clerk in a battery clerk type of stuff, and I might say that's where Cimarron High School comes in. My year of typing there, when somebody learned I couldn't peck away, why, I was the battery clerk, which was a good job. I liked that unit. That unit, the 49th Field Artillery, had a history to it in Korea. The 17th Regiment of the 7th Infantry Division in 1950 made it all the way to the Yalu River. And the 49th Field Artillery Battalion was the artillery support. And then, of course, the Chinese came down, and they had to withdraw fast. I think the 7th Infantry Division commander maybe violated some order. He wasn't to retreat until ordered, but he retreated. He saw the situation, so he started the withdrawal. But then about 2 or 3 weeks after I was in the 49th Field, another question came down. I guess they were going to start troop information and education as part of the non-war, give these troops something to do. And somebody had found that I had graduated from college with an education degree, no experience, but they asked me if I wanted to go down and be the head NCO of the TINE unit, and that's where I am there in that photograph. And they did, and we didn't do anything exotic. The Army issued some material every week, and I would hold meetings with what troops were available. And this was news. You know, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't have radios or things like that. So we didn't know what was going on back home. And I don't recall we got the Stars and Stripes or the Army paper very much. But I would go out and give a little weekly seminar on that. And then we, to begin with, we tested out soldiers from the 7th Infantry Division artillery that might qualify to be tested out for GEDs. And if they didn't test out, of course, then it meant they needed more training, and we could figure out what kind of tutoring or what type of aid or classes could be set up. But quite a number of them could test out, and of course that meant they could really gain something in the Army. And so my last months in the Army were spent in troop information and education. It did mean, well, it meant that I could get a, I did get a sergeant rank. It was good. It did mean that I lost my MOS, my FDC, Fire Direction Center MOS. And I kind of hated that. They gave me a TINE MOS, a Troop Information and Education. And so when my time was up, why, I rotated home by troop ship again. It was October, I think the Giants were playing somebody in the World Series. We could hear the radio when we got close enough to Seattle, which was very good. Trip over, trip back was a lot better than the trip over. And they flew us from Seattle to Fort Carson, Colorado, where I went through the process of being honorably separated from the Army. Clarence drove out to get me. And I don't think I wore the uniform back. I don't know if I wore the uniform more than once or so in Cimarron. Yeah, I hate to tell something like that. I had to be inspected. Major sat there to see if the uniform met the specifications. First time I went up there, it didn't. And so next time I went up there, why, it was just form-fitting.
I see.
It was a good fit, but, yeah. And so, but he liked it. And so I said, if it's all right with you, why, that's fine. But the reason I say that, I didn't wear the uniform much. Later on, I was asked to speak at a Rotary meeting. So somebody had known that I was in Korea. But I sat down beside a fella, a businessman from Cimarron, who ran the Chevrolet place, mm-hmm. Carl McGuirt.
Aha.
And Carl asked me, he hadn't seen me much, where had I been?
Oh.
So.
Outside the county.
Outside the county, that's right. Yeah, so there was a little bit of that, but that's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right.
That's interesting.
Well, I don't know if I've got much more.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things. The trip over on this ship, had you been on this ship before? Had you traveled outside Kansas much before when you took off for those far reaches?
No, I don't. Well, I think... I'd probably been to Colorado. But yeah, I'd been to Colorado. Mm-hmm. And when we graduated from high school, why, Wayne Wheeler from Galveston and John Pixley and I and one other person, John got the family vehicle. And we drove down to Carlsbad Caverns after we graduated from high school.
Uh-huh.
And we drove down to El Paso, I guess, and parked the car and walked across into Mexico.
Oh.
You know, just mm-hmm. three mm-hmm. blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back, say mm-hmm. we'd been out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's about it.
Wow. What was it like? I'm just intrigued by the fact that having grown up similar environment to you in Kansas, where we're certainly landlocked and there's not that much water, to be on a ship for, I assume it had to be several weeks to make the trip.
Yeah, it was, I don't know how long, clear around to when we had to stop in Sasebo, and then we had to go around. when we included those days, probably 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
The weather was rough. The weather was rough, and so everybody got sick, very sick. Not everybody, but,
mm-hmm.
and it took about 3 days, because once you kind of started feeling better, then you'd start, and you had to get in line. Of course, we were down in the bowels of the ship,
mm-hmm.
so you had to climb up to some deck. I don't know where it was, where the
mm-hmm.
food was. And so you'd get up, and I hate to talk about this around dinner time, but you'd get stand on the stairs, and somebody would get sick ahead of you. Or you'd start to smell
my.
The food.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you'd just back off and go back down to your bunk. Now, there were guys who could stand it. I don't know whether they had Dramamine or what. But they'd bring back oranges, and I discovered oranges would stay down.
Oh, okay.
And so after 3 or 4 days, I guess we didn't wonder about the sea. We wondered about whether we were going to make it.
Yeah.
And then they'd get us up on deck every day and wash down the living areas.
Oh, yeah.
Hose down the floors
oh
and everything.
Oh, my gosh.
That sort of stuff. You had to be sure your duffel bag was up on your bunk, and you had about 3 or 4 bunks high, you know. And the thing I remember about that, it seemed like the Navy guys or Merchant Marine or whatever they were, they were always painting. Paint, I guess the corrosion of the salt water with stair handles.
But then you'd have that paint smell on top of that. Wow.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe that was better than the alternative, huh?
But everybody was forced up. You had to go up and get your breath of fresh air.
Did you mostly sleep then? I mean, or could you read down there?
Well, we had lights, but of course they could turn off the lights.
Yeah.
We didn't have nothing to read.
Huh.
So you just slept or talked. Maybe somebody had a deck of cards. I know there were people who were awake. One guy claimed the ship stopped somewhere out in the middle of the Pacific one night, and he went up on deck. I don't know how that was possible. But we rendezvoused with a submarine.
Oh.
A submarine had surfaced,
oh.
and they were, I guess, sending messages back and forth or doing something like that.
Huh.
But one thing, compared to World War II, we didn't have to worry about submarines.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little aghast here. I didn't give you any great illuminating story.
Oh, it's fascinating. I couldn't interrupt at all. Wanted to hear what you were saying. Tell me this: what was your first impression of Korea when you stepped off the ship? And just was it like stepping off into another world? Was it familiar? Did you?
Now Incheon is a harbor that the, as I understand, the, what do we want to call it, the tides are high.
Okay.
And so at certain times you come in, when the tide is low, you can come way in, but then you sit there, the ship sits there on mud flats.
Oh.
I think they had that problem, you know, when they invaded it, Incheon. So we came off the ship from landing barges. We didn't go down a pier or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the landing barges then took us over the mud flats and to the shore.
Yeah.
And getting to your answer very fast, but we just sat on the shore, all the troops off the ship. It was like we unloaded in the morning. And we just sat there And ever so often, a truck would come and pick up a group of soldiers. Now, we were going to Chunchon, and so we sat there the whole day. And so I guess my first impression, there's a picture in here of, and what I saw was just all these LSTs and all these troops, and we all sitting on the shore. Then I boarded a train at night. They took, Chunchon was about in the middle of Korea, and it was, they had the curtains down, and as I said earlier, it maybe went 15, 20 miles an hour, and I don't suppose it was more than 80 miles over there to Chunchon. We were. And so we arrived, the first countryside was dark. We got our sea rations and so forth on the train, and we unloaded then at Chunchon at night, and a truck came to get us for the 196th Field Artillery Battalion the next day. And by that time, we were over in the kind of mountainous part of Korea. So I didn't, I don't know. I guess I didn't think much about what it looked like or what it expected or that sort of business.
And it sounds like you were out in mountainous terrain rather than near a city.
Yeah.
Or matter of fact, villages, any, yeah.
All the villages had been obliterated, or let's say, I don't know what it actually is, but 5 or 10 miles back of the front, you know, we're in there. There were rice paddies. They still grew rice. There were some rice farmers, but there were no villages. And I even had to drive down to Chunchon once to get an officer. And it was just mountainous and following rivers, and until we got Chunchon. Chunchon was a pretty good-sized place. So I never did have contact with the Koreans, the native folks.
Right, right.
I had a chance once to ride in the back of a truck over to Seoul. But you had to ride the dust, and the dust, and the dust had, could easily have dust of, could have spores of tapeworms and stuff in it.
Ow.
So I didn't figure too much. And then somebody always had to stand guard at the vehicle so they didn't steal the tires or something. So I didn't figure it'd be much of a trip. So I never went to Seoul.
Oh, okay.
I did go to Japan twice on R&R.
That was going to be a question. Okay.
One time I flew, and there I was impressed. We came into the airfield to land. It was at Kokura, and there was a cafe on the airfield, or near the airfield, and it had neon lights. And after being, you know, we didn't have any lights at night, and it was mud, dark, kind of like Gray County. when they turned off the coal oil lamps.
Right.
You know? And there was that neon sign of different colors, flashing or something. I thought, it impressed me.
Wow.
To see that. Now, I can still remember when I saw my first neon sign in Dodge City. My grandparents lived over there.
Really?
And I think somebody said, well, let's go downtown and see the neon signs. And
wow.
Then Tuggles, you know, got a neon sign.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that was coming up. Clark's
nice.
Got a neon sign.
Big time.
Big time.
What'd you do in Japan on R&R?
Well, you mostly rested. The second R&R, was to Kobe. And I took a took a fine train, fast train, to from Kobe up to Kyoto. Kyoto was the old capital of Japan, so they had a lot of the old buildings, gardens, and so it was a true sightseeing experience. And of course, you always had the food, and you always had the hotel, and you had your friends that you went with, so to speak. It was a, I might say they had an R&R when I was in Korea with the combat unit. I said earlier the battalion never did, was on the front line. The artillery battalion was on their front line, which wasn't like the infantry. But for about a year and a half, most units, you know, they'd put the infantry up there for 30 days, and they suffered shell fire every day or something, every night. And then after 30 days, they'd pull them, the whole division out, put in another division. Well, they didn't do that with the artillery, but they did provide, if after you were there 30 days in our unit, you could go back for a kind of a overnight or a weekend. And the only thing you did there was you could sleep as long as you wanted to. Breakfast went until 10 o'clock. You know, you just didn't have army duties. So that was pretty much the way it was. You know Russell Schartz? Now, is Russell on your list?
We interviewed Russell.
And he was, part of his duty was transporting troops from R&R.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew he was a driver, yeah.
Well, I was thinking, once he had a duty of serving the... Well, on one R&R we flew, one R&R we went by an LST across the Sea of Japan because all the airplanes are being used in Indochina.
And what's an LST?
Oh, it's a landing craft tank or something like that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it was big enough that it could go across the ocean, but it could carry a lot. And they had converted it to carry soldiers back and forth across it. But I was understanding he worked with that once. And as a matter of fact, he worked with when I went to R&R, I didn't recognize him. I guess he recognized me, I think. Because one time I saw him at a reunion. Russell was, I don't know, what was he in the sixth grade when I graduated or something?
Yeah.
I didn't have much.
He graduated with ARC.
Oh, okay.
Senior, my first year there.
But I talked to Kenny Weens. Like when Kenny Weens went on R&R, Russell had him stay in his quarters on the LST. Of course, they were pretty close together in high school. But on that R&R, and I sometimes wonder if this wasn't it, when I came back to board the ship again to return to Korea, there was, you know, you have these TV programs where they send the message, the TV, back to the folks back home. Well, I got pulled out and interviewed for that.
Oh.
And they did send it to... the St. Joseph, Missouri station, since Clarice was from Atchison County. And she was teaching up there a year when I was in Korea. And I sometimes wonder if Russell pointed me out to them. I did call, I should mention here too, I did when I was in Japan, I did call Clarice One time.
That was a big deal then.
Of course, I didn't keep in mind the time of day to change. I didn't keep in mind whether she was at her sister's at here or there. They had to chase her around. We did talk.
Luckily, they found me in Topeka. My sisters weren't on country lines.
Oh, wow.
And it cost me, or cost her.
Really? Oh, my gosh, that was a lot. Oh, my goodness.
So I guess
it must have been worth it.
It was.
She went to pick you up when you got out. So.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the food and, just life. I assume you slept in a tent on a cot or?
Yes. When I first got there, I slept in a bunker for several nights. I didn't like that. It was tight. It would have been good, better than a tent under shell fire. But a bunker is composed of logs, a log roof with canvas laid over, sandbags laid over that maybe, canvas. Okay. And then the canvas has rips in it. When it rains, it's like any flat roof.
Yeah.
The water runs from here over to here, and then it leaks. You never know whether it leaks. I know one night it rained, and my cot was in the rain. But rats, you could hear rats run above you in the night. It's better to sleep in tents, but I slept in tents. Now, what did you...
Well,
food?
What? Yeah.
Well, we had good food. I don't think I ever complained about the food. Army chow. We usually had Korean help. They let boys come up and work, and they would do our washing if you paid them a little in script.
Oh,
or they might have provided our haircut. One of them might have been a barber. So we had contact, and there were Katusas, Korean soldiers attached to the U.S. Army's Katusas, they called them. And so we had that contact with native people. One thing I remember about food, and I guess this was with 10th Corps Artillery. No, it had to be 7th Infantry Division Artillery Headquarters. Why, our cook kept getting just tons of sweet potatoes. And we were close then to the British Commonwealth Division. And their cook got a lot of white potatoes. And so the cooks would change food.
Oh.
So they valued sweet potatoes. And we liked white potatoes once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So cooks weren't beyond doing that sort of trading. But Korean food, I never did eat any Korean food, that sort of thing. I was trying to think, something slipped my mind. I can't remember.
What do you call about the latrines and showering and...
Yeah. Well, when the war was on, you didn't have much of a change of clothes until a unit came around, a truck came around, a shower. It could pull up to a creek and take the water from the creek and convert it into a shower,
Okay, so like a mobile shower?
Mobile shower.
Oh, really?
A mobile shower truck.
Yeah.
And they had clean clothes, change of clothes. But you didn't wear any insignia on your clothes. No rank or name or anything like that, because under those circumstances, you didn't know whether they fit well or didn't fit well. You just got
that whatever you got.
And now I know that another Korean veteran I know here, he's dead from Topeka. He wore the same clothes for 30 days on the line in the 1st Cav Division. And then when they were sent back, well, they just burned all their clothes.
Oh.
So I know it's a tough situation, so I almost feel like I was standing at the Hilton when I had mine. But see, was there another part to your question?
Well, the battle, just I was thinking of the day-to-day life things, like the latrine and
latrines.
Like that. But did you kind of have your tents were in an area, so you kind of lived in the same place, or were you moving around, or?
Yeah, let's see. Well, this is a tent that I've been.
Oh, okay.
That's the new tent, that's the one that the shell went through.
Oh, okay.
And you can see the ground's awful rocky.
Right.
This would show a road going through our area, and you can kind of see tents buildings.
So like a little military village.
Military village, and that's why I say we had these other sections close to us. So we were this was how the firing batteries looked. That picture couldn't be, but there are two different shots. It just kind of
gives you a feeling.
I don't know, somewhere in here, it's hard to pick them out. Probably here is one of the where the guns are.
Oh,
I think the guys lived kind of in a bunker there, right, with the howitzer.
Yes.
But you can see that war is environmentally hard on the ground, the land, because this is highly eroded.
So they, if the gun is here in the lower left, is facing this way or facing me?
It's facing over away. The ridge.
Okay.
And there was a ridge something like this back here. We were back here. That separated us from this.
Yeah. Wow. So the artillery was in front of you?
Yes.
Okay.
Our artillery.
You didn't have to duck all the time.
Or we didn't hear the noise so much from them.
Yeah.
Okay. But there was an artillery battery at four guns behind us, and we certainly heard that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. What about holidays? You were there over the holidays in 1953.
Okay, now that's not. Thanks for reminding me. I was there one Christmas and Thanksgiving and Fourth of July. One of the Fourth of July, the war was on. So that wasn't. But the second Fourth of July. That would have been in 1954. We were close to some British units, and so at the Division Artillery Headquarters, the commanding officer was a brigadier general. And I guess he approved, at least, of inviting a British unit to come over and eat with us. And we played softball. We had a picnic. I mean, as best the Army can provide. And we had time off. But it was kind of interesting. It caused me to wonder. Now, I don't know if, when I say British, the British Commonwealth Division included troops from New Zealand, Canada, South Africa. It could have been a Canadian unit. But nonetheless, they were British. The subject of the 4th of July never did come up.
You just sort of did a reenactment of the Revolutionary War, didn't you?
But I wondered.
With hot dogs.
That caused me to think in World War II there were Americans stationed over there for
sure
4 or 5 years. And how did they handle the 4th of July?
Right.
Now, Christmas, we got a special meal. We even had a menu. I've got a copy of one of the menus because they left them. They had a menu on every table in the mess hall, mess tent.
Oh.
And I was one of the last groups to go through. Mm-hmm. And I asked the mess sergeant if I could have it. But, I mean, we had
the whole dinner.
Works. Thanksgiving, I don't know so much. But
what was that like, being away from home that far?
Well, it's kind of like the war itself. I always think you, of course, I wasn't in the infantry. You could tell by that I had a I had an easy go. But I think you end up thinking of your buddies, those who are around you. That's who you're fighting for. And that's who you talk to. That's who you think about. So if you have good buddies, and I had some real good buddies. This is a picture. I'm on the end here. But it was people like that. It didn't dwell very much. And then Clarice was good. She wrote. She kept the post office in business at Lancaster. I got free mail, you know, to send.
And I paid air mail.
Yeah, you paid air mail, but I didn't get a letter every day, but sometimes I'd get 2 or 3 letters. But we corresponded, and so I think, of course, she was good. She had run out of things to say. By that I mean, what do you write if you write often? Well, she wrote about the noise the squirrels are making on the roof or something, you know, the house for folks, and all the little things. So I knew pretty much what was going on.
Fill up a page.
Did you get care packages?
I got one care package from an aunt, and it was for my, well, it was just a care package, and she had baked a angel food cake and surrounded it by popcorn or something, and she sent it when I was in this process of, you know, I told you I was moving from place to place. And it followed me and followed me and
followed me.
And by the time it got to me, it had a hole in it. And the, half the popcorn had leaked out.
Oh.
And the cake was dry.
Oh.
And, well, it was a thought that counted.
Oh, my goodness.
I did say, one of the things I did when we got home and we're at Cimarron, after I got home, we didn't quite know what to do. I was home in the middle of November, but I ended up checking college out since I had the GI Bill. And I ended up going to Emporia State to get a master's degree in biology, and then I got a specialist in education degree later on from KU through the GI Bill. But now, again, I've lost my train of thought.
When you got home after the package, I think.
Well, oh, yeah. Why, I know my folks owned a little house in town. We sanded the floor of it, that house. You know, what do? We went around and visited family. And, but I did get together a box of canned goods, which I thought I would have liked to have got in Greece.
Oh.
because I had guys over there I knew, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't too much of a box, but and we mailed it over to the 100, to the 7th Infantry Division.
Let me guess, Vienna sausages?
Yeah.
Spam.
Spam, that's
uh-huh.
right.
Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Meats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Potted meats.
Potted
called
meats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't green beans and corn.
Okay. Did you send anything back? Bring any mementos back or anything like that?
No.
You did order things like dishes.
Oh, yeah. Now, at Christmas, this would have been in the fall of 53, they had a van that came around with samples of goods we could order from Japan. And this was dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an example. And there were scarves or sweaters.
I got a robe.
A robe.
Oh.
And, of course, they would just knock it off your pay. So I guess that was sent from, it was Japanese. But, no, I didn't receive any special thing. I wanted to know whether you wanted a memento. Did you ever see?
Oh, how cool. The stamp. Oh, isn't that nice?
But I'll give that to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
There's the stamp, you know.
Oh, my goodness, look at that. Well, how wonderful.
No, I didn't bring any. My brother in World War II, he brought home a Japanese rifle. He ended up from the Philippines to Okinawa to Japan. He was in the Air Force. But stuff like that. You read about guys sending home enough parts of a Jeep to have a Jeep.
Oh, really? No, I didn't hear that, but a lot of people have mentioned sending home China.
Yeah,
I think there must be a lot of Japanese China sets in and around Cimarron or in Gray County.
Yeah, and then we did find the set that I sent home in Montgomery Ward one time.
Wow.
I picked up some extra plates and cups and saucers.
Oh, goodness. My uncle Charlie Rice was in that era. I need to go to Oklahoma and interview him, but he sent my mother a set of Japanese china while he was over there. So. We talked about getting together with your friends, but you mentioned a story before we started interviewing about getting together with John and John Pixley and Art Thomas. What was that?
Let's see. I got together with Art Thomas and Kenneth Weems.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. They were in Korea, and that would have probably been about in August of 54. I came home in September of 54.
September, got home in October.
October of 54. October, you're right. That's right.
How'd they find you? Did one of them just... Would they have called you, written you a letter, just showed up?
Well, it had to be through Cimarron, like my mother and Hulda Weems, and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in making contact with me, I think Art called me or something. Art was a pretty good... What do I want to say? Conniver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, he talked him out of a Jeep, the Army. And as I remembered, they were talking about when they got to me, they had driven through, like, someplace they shouldn't have been, like the DMZ or something. You know, they just driving through roads. I don't see how they... handled everything. I don't really know what units they were in. I don't remember. But they found me, and I knew they were coming. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a surprise, but how they did that, I don't know.
Wow.
But I think he ended up in Las Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. Art?
Mm-hmm. Art did.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what he did.
You know what amazes me about this story, and you mentioning John Pixley and Russ Schartz, I mean, Cimarron was maybe 1,500 people around that time, if that many, and how could it be that you all could end up bumping into each other in Korea, given the thousands of troops that were there, and it isn't like you set out and said, let's exchange addresses and make sure we get together if we end up in Korea, mm-hmm. but isn't that remarkable how that seems to happen? We hear that again and again in the stories, but that kind of connection is amazing to me when you think of how small the county is or how small the community is.
But, you know, I don't think there was any other boy from Kansas in the battery that I was in. And that's 150, 180 guys. You'd think, mm-hmm. well, there'd be somebody. But it's just a chance thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, in kind of summarizing, when you look back on this whole experience, what are the lessons you took from it? How would you summarize your experience in the scope of your entire life? How influential was it? What lessons did you take away?
Well, I guess I was blessed being able to go over there and come back. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's one of the things. I was blessed with support from my family, mm-hmm. my wife. We have a daughter-in-law who's Korean. Our son was working on his PhD in chemistry at the University of Illinois, and she was in his little research group. She's a native of Korea, and they got married. So that kind of changed things. For her, you know, I was part of saving South Korea. Mm-hmm. And we have that family tie now. Mm-hmm. I have a granddaughter in college. I mean, mm-hmm. their child, mm-hmm. part Korean. And so I don't know if that aspect would have popped up so much. Mm-hmm. Now, in the 60th anniversary of the Korean War, they did produced a book, a nice book they gave to Korean veterans. I got a copy, which emphasized Korea in 1953 in Korea now, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. with all these. And I hear veterans who go over there, they say, well, they've got six-lane highways, and they've got all of this, you know. Mm-hmm. It confounds them. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've learned that all through the marriage of my son since they went over. Mm-hmm. That Korea has really changed. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I'd have thought about that much if I didn't have the...
Mm-hmm. That connection. Have you ever wanted to go back?
Well, in the beginning, I didn't want to go back. There was some time, and I always thought it's a long trip, even by plane. Mm-hmm. And they do offer, even today, they offer trips, but I've got pulmonary fibrosis, a lung condition where the tissue between the lung sacs is kind of hardened up.
Oh.
And well, if I could just do like that.
And
know.
Be there. Teletransport. Well, anything else you can think of I haven't mentioned? Your most memorable moment? Any funny stories we missed? Or
memorable, poignant stories?
Yeah, I think I've told it pretty much.
Well,
you could look.
I surely thank you. We're going to definitely go through these photographs and see what we can get copied. And so,
You can. Yeah, I'd be glad to let you have these, and if you get them back to me.
Yes, I definitely. In fact, what I'll do is I'll go out this afternoon and make a list and have them take. What I think I'll have them do is just copy them, and then we'll have a list of what I leave them to scan, because it'll take them a little while to scan them. They have to use their hotshot scanner thing to get good resolution and things, but then I'll make sure that we have the list, and that way we can get them to scan it, and then we can bring them back. But, okay, I'm going to stop this. Good one.
I didn't carry the picture of Clarice.
Oh, okay. So you carried everything of value with you.
Well, you can see he's got his pockets. Pockets are full of stuff. He's got a carton of cigarettes.
Okay.
We didn't have any PX during the war. After the war, the ceasefire, then we kind of got a little PX.
So after that shower and you got these uniforms, didn't matter if they didn't fit, but you carried your plate with you too, your tray, your...
Well, you can see a tray hanging. Maybe there's a picture of me and this one standing. You carried your tray with you.
Okay.
Are you... Just put it outside then.
Oh, okay, just so you had it around. Okay.
Yeah, they had...
wow. Okay. Did everyone smoke? I mean, was that kind of the standard?
Yeah, I guess I took up smoking. I didn't smoke before I went over there. But you got your C rations and stuff. You always got cigarettes and...
And he quit when he got home because I didn't allow him.
Oh, good. Thank you. Wow. Well, I surely do appreciate
you. I guess I've gone a lot longer.
And I'm going to just keep recording. Okay.
I don't have. Oh, you can take this with you if you want. But this is a history of our battalion.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And they, from about... From about, this page, it tells that stuff.
Okay.
But...
I'll take a copy of that, and then we can stick it with this. That'll be good.
Page. But I...
Okay.
I wouldn't know that as a individual.
Right. Well, we'll stick that with this, and it looks like you have a map.
Yeah, I would... We would be up about up here.
Okay.
And this is...
The top right above the 38.
This is the 38.
Uh-huh.
And I went down to 10th Corps.
Okay.
And then I went over to the 7th Infantry, which is north of Seoul.
Okay. Wow.
And there, if you want an authentic, there's a guard duty roster.
Oh, how fabulous. That is great. Well, I'm going to get copies of all of this, and we'll make sure we get that in there and that I get everything back to you.
Okay.
And that will be fabulous.